The diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks have revealed all sorts of information, from worries about Iran throughout the Middle East and the difficulties of dealing with Pakistan to embarrassingly frank assessments of world leaders like French President Nicolas Sarkozy, Afghan President Hamid Karzai, and Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. And they also reveal another widespread problem. Joining me for a look at what the leaked diplomatic cables say about worldwide corruption is Elizabeth Dickinson, the Assistant Managing Editor for Foreign Policy Magazine. I'm pleased to welcome her back to our show for today's backstory. Hello.
Hi. Nice to speak with you.
A 2008 cable alleges that the president of Nigeria, Umaru Yar Adua, has used a businessman named Dahiro Mangal to smuggle things into his country. What sorts of things?
Well, we're talking about everything from sort of weapons to, you know, Chinese consumer goods, the whole gambit of things. So essentially, what this cable reveals is that the president of Nigeria had someone in his close proximity who was sort of ready to do the dirty jobs that wouldn't be fitting of a normal diplomatic advisor. So this was sort of the handyman that he turned to when he needed something, quote unquote, taken care of, if you will.
But in this case, some of the things that are smuggled in, I would have thought would have just been understood as the prerogative of a president.
Indeed, no, that's a very good point. I think what's happening in this situation is likely we're talking about contraband that's coming into the country. Mentioned in the cable specifically, there's allusions to, for example, weapons. There's allusions to other goods that would be more complicated to get, not on the black market, shall we say. There's no specific mention about how his services was used, but what we do know is that should he have needed it, the president of Nigeria had this at his disposal, the ability to import things illicitly.
And Mr. Mangal is the right person for this because he owns an airline?
Well, he doesn't own an airline. What he actually owns is a sort of large set of shipping containers that go overland from Niger into Nigeria. So this is part of the Sahel Desert. It's a very sort of lawless place to navigate. And so essentially what this businessman did was knew the ins and outs of the system and was able to bring things in that it would be very difficult for someone who didn't have that sort of ground experience to do.
And is this just for the president of Nigeria? What about other government officials and the country's elite?
Well, we can be sure that this man, his client was not, his only client was not the president. That is to be sure. And we don't know a lot about sort of who his other clients would be, but we do learn a lot about the volume of what this man is bringing into the country. The source that spoke with the diplomats in the U.S. Embassy in Abuja in Nigeria estimated that he brought in about 100 containers full of goods a month into the market in the northern city of Kano. So, you know, you can imagine what sort of things this might be. It might be harmless things such as consumer goods. It might also include those illicit goods that we discussed a moment ago.
Well, should we be at all surprised? Corruption in Nigeria has been well known for years, much of it in connection with its oil reserves.
No, I think that's a big surprise here is actually the direct link with the former president, Umaru Yar Adua. When Mr. Yar Adua came to office, his biggest public image campaign was around the idea that here was a leader of Nigeria who was finally going to be very different, very clean. He's a former chemistry professor himself. He was renowned before becoming president as being one of the most effective governors of a local state. He got things done. He was supposed to be transparent. And what we learned behind the scenes is these very interesting and more shady links within his cabinet and his government really ask questions about that image, particularly because his own wife is seen as one of the main protagonists in these stories. So this is a woman by the name of Turai Yar Adua, who was long sort of rumored to be involved in a number of corrupt schemes, even if her husband, the president, was not. We get more details about that in the cable, as well as her links with this particular smuggle, but also with other deals that were going on during the presidency. So, for example, land grabs, extorting bribes on certain people in order to, you know, achieve things such as their land contracts to start a business, things of that nature. So this is really shattering any illusions that we had about the former administration in Nigeria being sort of clean.
Didn't I read in the paper that she sued a Nigerian newspaper that's reported on the story for slander?
I believe that that was actually in another country.
Oh, another, I'm sorry, another corruption issue. I'm sorry, I'm mixing up all my corruption problems here.
No, but it's a similar sort of story, actually. In Zimbabwe, the first lady of Zimbabwe, the wife of Robert Mugabe, has similar shady connections with the diamond business that are reported in the cables. One of the Zimbabwean newspapers printed that cable and has since been sued by the first lady, which is really actually quite a precarious situation in Zimbabwe, a place where press freedom is already quite imperiled. So this is really a serious problem.
There's also a collection of cables from the embassy in Baku, Azerbaijan, that describe what's allegedly going on there. Who's involved in that corruption?
Well, here again, we're touching very close to the pinnacle of power in the country. So some of the cables that we looked at in particular discussed the business dealings of a particular family. And it's the Hadreyev family, who happens to be the monopolistic brokers of the juice market, of all things. This is a very lucrative industry in this part of the world, as pomegranate grows very prominently there, and is that's a big part of this country's agricultural exports. So this man is sort of the mogul of the juice market, but he also has his hands in concrete, in asphalt, in CD and DVD production, in textiles, pianos, alcohol, anything. You name it. And basically what these cables...
Isn't he also a composer?
Indeed. Indeed. So one of the great things about these cables is they really humanize some of the diplomats behind them, and those sorts of anecdotes really make you understand the complex situation that these diplomats are trying to navigate and understand.
Well, why would the pomegranate man be a problem? Is it because the U.S. aid had attempts to... help pomegranate farmers there, which would have made Mr. Hadreyev rather upset?
Well, that's part of the issue. But I think more broadly what this cable represents and what this story more broadly touches upon is the way that Azerbaijan's market functions, which is really quite monopolistic and really centered around a few key families who literally control every industry in the country. So if you want to start a business, for example, in pomegranate juice in Azerbaijan, you would have a very difficult time doing so simply because competition is not permitted under this system. So what we're looking at is the real entrenchment of particular family interests, a sort of oligarchy, if you will. And what the diplomats are sort of realizing through this cable is that this is the atmosphere in which they're going to try to operate. So if they want to, for example, promote small businesses, they're going to have to get the permission of these important families. They're going to have to navigate his business contacts and figure out what is and is not allowed, if you will.
There are also allegations in the cables that the judicial system of Azerbaijan involves judges who can be bought, that building safety officials can also be bought. There's a big building boom there in recent years, and it's thought that if there's an earthquake, everything is going to fall down. And then there's the Ministry of Emergency Situations, which sounds like something out of Monty Python. What does that do?
Well, exactly. And I think that was sort of the main question that the diplomats had when they looked at it, what on earth can this mean? Essentially, what this businessman, Mr. Hadreyev, is the minister of the Ministry of Emergency Situations and has sort of taken this title to be a prerogative of pretty much everything. So if you're the Minister of Emergencies, you can sort of claim an emergency in the housing sector, in the transportation sector, in the security sector, and he's used that as a way to tap into his particular business interests into the functioning of the system.
We're talking with Elizabeth Dickinson, assistant managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine, on today's backstory, which is looking at what the WikiLeaks cables reveal about corruption around the world. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. The State Department cables also discuss the control that the first family of Tunisia has over business in that country. How has that alleged corruption made it impossible for McDonald's to start doing business there?
Well, this is a very interesting story. Tunisia is a northern African country, one of the big success stories of the last 5 years. Economic growth that's really been almost exponential. They've improved a lot of their systems, health systems, education, whatnot. But behind the scenes, we learned that, in fact, there is still this very oligarchic economy going on in the background, and specifically the ruling family, which is called very euphemistically the family, so you get the sort of mafia intonation of what's going on here, is really behind the scenes of everything. So same, very similar story to what we saw in Azerbaijan. Essentially, if you want to start a business, if you want to have your business operate without being troubled by the police, by security issues, you need to have the ruling family on board. So, great case example. McDonald's tried to enter the Tunisian market a few years back, and what they found is very quickly that they were going to have ties to the ruling family. They decided that that was not something that they were prepared to do, and so after having made the public push to come out and try and enter the market, they backed out.
Should they have just changed their name to Burger King?
Perhaps that would have been a good PR plug, perhaps.
So what happens when these stories are revealed? Has the government responded to the allegations?
Well, this is another case in which they have responded. The royal family, and particularly the first lady who was named in these cables, has struck back. For example, one of the newspapers that published the cables was again shut down. The first lady has denied all accusations against her in the cables. But this is actually perhaps one of the most powerful things that the WikiLeaks can accomplish in their transparency, is really sort of calling these things out. In many of the countries that we're talking about here, a lot of these stories are rumored or very widely accepted to be true, but seeing them sort of coming from this official diplomatic source can really have a big impact.
I'm surprised that some of the leaks about Russia didn't come out in the debate over signing this arms treaty. Senator Kyle must have been thrilled to read some of these things. Go ahead.
No, that's exactly right. Russia is described over and over again in these cables as really a mafia state that really has no chance of saving itself from corruption. I believe in one cable that I'm recalling, there's even the, you know, they speak with several sources within Russia, within the Russian government, who say, you know, there's just nothing we can do about the level of corruption. It's too prominent. It's too widespread. And we're talking about corruption from the very top to the very bottom. So one of the cables, for example, it specifically talks about the former mayor of Moscow and his involvement in the criminal syndicate that largely controls that city. But we're talking everything from that level of very high corruption all the way down to sort of bribing your way out of a speeding ticket.
Well, the mayor, Yuri Lushkov, was fired in September, but not because of the corruption that the cables alleged?
Not because of that. In fact, I believe that this is sort of speaking in my own personal analysis and not of the WikiLeaks themselves, but there was something of a power struggle going on with the mayor of Moscow. And I believe what happened, probably the Russian government knew about what was going on, knew about these dealings, because, again, this is one of those things that is well widely known and accepted in some of these countries. But they chose to sort of deal with him, and he was becoming too powerful, in a sense.
Now, the people did pay attention to one of the leaks about whether Vladimir Putin is a very detached prime minister. Is that because he's really the all-powerful leader of Russia and isn't interested in the day-to-day responsibilities of a prime minister?
That is the million-dollar question, and I think every intelligence operation in the world is trying to figure that out, so I won't try to answer it.
It appears that WikiLeaks is teaming up with the newspaper Novaya Gazeta and is about to start releasing information about government corruption in Russia. Do you have any idea how the Russian government will react when they're published? Will they call them terrorists, as people call WikiLeaks people in this country?
It's possible. It's very possible. And again, this is one of the trickiest issues that WikiLeaks raises in countries that are less than 100% democratic, is do you protect the freedom of the press when once the WikiLeaks are out there, you know, regardless of what you think of WikiLeaks itself, the prerogative of we in the media is to sort of report on the information that's public. And many of the governments in these countries are cracking down. This is a very alarming trend. We saw it in Zimbabwe. We saw it in Tunisia. We're seeing it over and over again. And so I think this is something really to watch unfold in the coming months.
Well, aren't all of these allegations of corruption in countries that are authoritarian or totalitarian? So the press is tightly controlled. We may know about it, but it's unlikely that the people in the populations of those countries will know much about it.
I'd like to believe that increasingly that's not the case, simply because of the proliferation of other sources through which people can receive information. So I'm talking not just about the internet, but cell phones, text messages, encrypted servers that allow people to read news sources that might otherwise be blocked by a firewall. I think this information is definitely feeding into the public, into the system. In very authoritarian places, it might not be as widespread. It might be limited to an elite. But once it gets into the country, it spreads rather quickly.
One of the more interesting stories, earlier this week, the Republic of Mauritius sued the British government based on a WikiLeaks cable that supported a claim that the British government had created a marine reserve out of an archipelago in order to prevent the return of 2,000 islanders who were forced to leave during the Cold War. This is the sort of thing where WikiLeaks are disclosures are creating diplomatic headaches for other countries as well, not just authoritarian and totalitarian countries.
Well, that's exactly right. And one of the interesting stories that we're following at Foreign Policy is the way that the WikiLeaks are creating sort of mini scandals all over the world. So another great example that we're watching here is in Malaysia, where the opposition leader has been on trial for supposed sodomy. Now, he claims that that's a political allegation, that his sort of semi-authoritarian opponent who is in power is put that charge up against him to keep him quiet, essentially. Some of the WikiLeaks reveal that he may have committed the crime. Now, of course, these are not definitive sources, but they have certainly kicked off a huge debate in Malaysia about these trials, and it's impossible to imagine the situation not being changed by what's been seen in WikiLeaks.
Of course, then we run into that whole other issue of whether people should be imprisoned for being homosexuals.
Precisely. Well, that's a whole other issue, I believe, yeah.
Now, we're not going to talk about the cables that involve corruption in Afghanistan. They've gotten quite a bit of attention. But do the diplomatic cables give a sense of what the American reaction is to this corruption? Are these cables meant to just relay that information back to Washington, or is it also intended to help Washington formulate policy?
Well, I think there's two parts to it. The first one is you really see in these cables that these diplomats are trying to navigate the situation. They're humans. They're like you and me. They're in a new place, many of them. They're trying to sort of understand what's the best way that we can operate. In many of these countries, understanding the system is extremely vital to getting anything accomplished. So, the first and foremost reason for some of these messages is simply, I believe, operational. So how do we work in these countries? The second piece is exactly as you mentioned. I think sort of here's the situation and here are some of the places where we might be able to target programs to improve the situation. So a great example here is Kenya. The U.S. government has been working very hard to promote anti-corruption policies, to reach out to everyday sort of on-the-street Kenyans and talk to them about corruption in the government. And in some of the cables, you do see specific pinpoints of, okay, here's an area we can have an impact as Americans. Let's focus our attention here.
We have a link to an article that Elizabeth Dickinson wrote with Joshua Keating about corruption in the WikiLeaks cables on our show page at WNYC.org. And I want to thank you so much for being with us, Elizabeth Dickinson, Assistant Managing Editor of Foreign Policy.
Thank you for having me.